suffering, stress taking place. And this particular discourse tells us a lot about how to go about investigating that. And it's kind of amazing discourse. It's only, I was trying to take a quick look, but maybe five, seven pages discourse. And this is a monk's thesis on it. It's kind of dense, you know. And Joseph Goldstein just published another book. He gave talks on it for, I don't know, several years, 30-some talks on it on dharmaseed.org. If you kind of look for Satipatthana Sutta and Joseph Goldstein, you can listen to what I'm going to try and talk about tonight in 30 or 40 minutes for, you know, 30, 40 hours instead. So obviously I'm going to be kind of highlighting things here. So this discourse on mindfulness or presence of mindfulness has four components, four areas where we're supposed to be mindful. And the first component is the body. And then the second component is something called, the Pali word is vedana. It's sort of usually translated as feeling tone. So it's not an emotion. It's just noticing whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. Or somewhere, you know, it doesn't have much charge to it, neutral. And then the third foundation is mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. Okay. So body, vedana, feeling tone, thoughts and emotions. And the fourth category of mindfulness is kind of cleverly said called mindfulness of dharma, which kind of ducks the question, what does dharma mean? What is he including in dharma that he didn't include in the first three? And Joseph Goldstein calls it categories of experience. And it's almost everything is in that four foundation with the kitchen sink, I think. The Four Noble Truths, which I just talked about as a separate discourse, is in the fourth category. The factors of awakening, hindrances, the aggregates, things that make us what we are. We're coming together of aggregates. We're not some solid thing. These are all in here. Now, I think, you know, there's some evidence of what happened was that initially it had a few things in it. Hindrances, factors of awakening, maybe aggregates, I'm not sure. And then over time, people added things into it. So when someone talks about the fourth factor of mindfulness, just be aware, it's like everything, just about the whole teaching's thrown in that fourth factor, okay? What's interesting about the first three foundations of mindfulness, at least to me, is that the Buddha doesn't tell us to do anything about it. He just says observe it. And there's a reason for that. Because every time we try and fix things, well, there's a lot of reasons for it, but every time we try and fix things or analyze it, we're kind of, all our unconscious stuff is coming up and defending ourselves. We're moving away from it. We're actually in this whole part of ourselves that created the problem in the first place. This whole thinking mind, emotions, we're lost in it. So he wants you to watch these factors of mindfulness long enough to get some understanding of it. And so that's kind of an aspect of what mindfulness is. It's, you know, one, I'm already out of the order I wrote down before I came over here, but one way of thinking what mindfulness is, it's not attention. It's has a quality of memory, of recollection. So if you're practicing, you know, one quality of recollection might be to know the Four Noble Truths, that there's suffering, there's a cause, you know what the cause is, there's cessation from it. And you can remember to look for dukkha. You recollect it, you keep it in mind, okay? Or if you're trying to develop calm, you know, just unifying the mind, then if you have a particular object you're working with, mindfulness says, well, keep coming back to it. So if you're working with the breath, mindfulness says, okay, you know, you get lost, mindfulness is bringing you back to the breath. That's what you're trying to be mindful of. And so in this discourse, Now, first you're being mindful of the body, then you're being mindful of Vedana, then you're being mindful of thoughts and emotions. And, you know, at some point you're just aware of whatever comes up. Okay. You know, it might be the most relevant thing might be an emotion at some point, or it might be an unpleasant feeling, or you might be, your knee hurts, and so you're mindful of the body and the mental reaction to that. Okay. And last week, I talked some about what I find a very useful way to practice. I mean, it's really, I do this a lot in my own practice, which is to kind of think of ourselves as these, you could call them programs, I guess would be one term to use, of body, heart, and mind. And, you know, when they're balanced, we have a sense of ease and empathy. But usually we're up in our head, and the head doesn't have any ground. You know, the only way I can get ground is to constantly spin, and boy, I can spin all kinds of what's going to happen to me, and I can't believe that person said this, and, you know, it goes on and on, right? And it's actually tiring. And you go to work, I mean, most of us, you know, do mental work, and you come home, we're tired, and we haven't done anything, really, in terms of physical stuff. But we actually use a lot of energy, physical energy. And the heart is likewise, it kind of gets pushed and pulled all the way around, all around. You know, you get praise, you feel good, you get blamed, you don't feel so great, you made some great investment, gain, you know, you feel good, and then the market crashes and you feel loss. You know, it's, so with the other, so these are called the four worldly winds, gain and loss, pain and pleasure. So you have pleasant feelings, and then all of a sudden the body starts hurting, and all of a sudden that shifts around. So the heart gets pushed around by these things. And so what I talked about last week was that it's really, if no matter how long you've been practicing, learning to be in the body is really a huge step. It sort of grounds you so you don't get lost in all this thought process and emotions. And it's actually a way to discharge emotions. When we think about what emotions are, you know, if you actually start examining them, which is sort of a quality of mindfulness, is observation, you know, they get expressed in the body in certain ways. I mean, it's all this language, you know, he's a pain in the neck, or get off my back, or, you know, you can come up with things, but basically the emotions get expressed in the body. So the way to release emotions, to work with them, is to come into the body, let them express themselves, and let them ground themselves. And we talked some about this last week, about sort of how the mind contracts around it, things. So you want to be spacious. So I'm getting a little bit off topic, but the reason I sort of talk about the body is, in this discourse on the presence of mindfulness, the first thing the Buddha has us do is be aware of the body. And it's partly because it's gross, it's manageable. You know, being with thoughts and emotions is really tricky. They got a lot of charge to them. But it's also that we start observing the body in very particular ways. We start, what's the word I want to use? I can't come up. Diffuse, lighten. We start seeing the body as something other than this visual perception we see as something that's solid and unchanging, you know, and all the kind of, you know, 1 millimeter thick part that we call beauty, you know, and you take all the skin off and then what's underneath there. I mean, the Buddha goes through all kinds of ways to be with the body. It's a way to be present, to be here now. That's what we're trying to do. And so one thing he says, well, be aware of the postures. Be aware you're standing. Be aware you're sitting. Be aware you're lying down. Be aware you're walking. And be aware of the change. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do there, right? I mean, and so you just sort of, I mean, it's great. You go to a store and you're standing in line and there's a big long line. You can just come into the body and be aware you're standing rather than getting caught up in impatience and I got to get this done and all that sort of thing. I mean, I remember actually I was on a 3-month retreat in England, and I was going home, and there was this huge line at the airport, and everybody's all fidgeting. Oh, it's just so at ease, you know. Just, oh well, just this moment, you know, just in the body. I mean, it's really helpful. So, I mean, he has us contemplate the body parts. You know, you have this idea of what you are, I'm whatever. But when you start contemplating the body parts, you kind of get a different view, right? I mean, you got a heart, a liver. I was kind of joking last week, I had a colonoscopy. Boy, that changed your view of what you are. You know, we're like 90% bacteria, right? I mean, you know, maybe it was 10% of what we are is human cells, right? And he has us contemplate how the body's changing. And there's a teacher I really love, Ajahn Sucitto, who has us, you know, rather than just watching the breath, you know, you watch the muscles that move the breath and see this, the shape of the chest is circular and the belly is circular. See how the muscles kind of pull down the diaphragm and expand the chest. And, you know, there's a lot of vitality there. And we're kind of lost up in this, the head, right? And then he kind of has you, after that, sort of just follow the breath. And you know, you think about the breath, well, it comes in here and goes, but you can feel the breath coming down through the back of the head. I mean, it's really quite interesting if you kind of, I mean, that's part of developing calm, is to take an interest. That we don't want to, like, oh, I'm going to concentrate. But we use a quality of wisdom to sort of, okay, how can I be at ease with this? And some of this is in the Satipatthana Sutta, so depending on how we go with time, I can talk about this. Okay, so that's kind of the general idea of the body. There's a whole bunch of, you contemplate death, and you know, it goes on and on, right? All these different practices within that, within the body. And then the second factor of mindfulness is vedana. It's just, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is neutral. And it's interesting because, you know, in the Buddhist kind of teaching, at every moment, there's what's called contact, which is simply a sense door, contacting a sense object, and a knowing of it. The three together are called contact. Okay? And that happens all the time. You know, all of a sudden we see an object, and there's a knowing of it, you know. Hit the bell, you hear sound, right? There's a knowing of the sound. Every time there's contact, what arises is something called perception, which is recognition. That is, when I hit the bell, recognition, the knowing of it, which is actually, okay, let me slow down here a little bit. When I say there's contact, sense door, sense object, and then consciousness, consciousness is at least in most of the discourses, is a very simple thing in Buddhism. It's not a noun. It's something that arises every time a sense door sees a sense object. So in the kind of the typical Buddhist way of teaching thing, there are, you know, there's hearing consciousness, seeing consciousness, feeling consciousness, and there's mental consciousness, and they're just all playing out. And with that contact, what co-arises, that arises at the same time, is vedana. Okay, it's pleasant, unpleasant, doesn't have a lot of charge. And there's perception, which is recognizing it. Okay, it labels things. This is a bell, or that's a bird, or that's a male, that's a female, it's tall, short. Those are all perceptions. And they actually co-arise every moment of contact. And what happens is from there, very much more complex thoughts and emotions come out of that. It's pleasant, I want more of it. If there's a perception that this is friendly, there's a sense of ease and warmth. There's a perception it's unfriendly, there's tightness and warmth. So part of this practice is starting to get down to this level, to really move beyond these broad thoughts and emotions which arise out of this, to see down underneath these components that drive it. And Baden is actually, I find very, very useful concept in practice. Because when we think about emotions we don't want to have, what is their characteristic? They have unpleasant vedana, unpleasant feeling tone, right? And it's in the body, usually. So for me, sometimes when I have a difficult emotion, just kind of, oh, it's unpleasant vedana, diffuses it some. You know, rather than getting lost in all this worry and all the pain and this sort of thing, oh, it's unpleasant. And so mindfulness, maybe sort of talk some more about what mindfulness is again. Like I said, it's to recollect, to remember something. So part of it is remember, you know, looking for suffering as cause, etc. But it's also to remember to focus on something. So if you have an emotion, then mindfulness might pay attention to the emotion and come down to, well, what is an emotion? And it, well, you know, we can say it's fear or anger or hatred, but when we look more deeply, you know, what is anger? What is fear? You know, it's some bodily sensation, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And not to dismiss it, but it's a way to kind of get down into the physicality of the experience. Okay. So now we've got body, which we want to ground ourselves in. Vedana, which helps us diffuse things a little bit. Consciousness, which is just the sense door, the knowing, the simple knowing. It's just, you know, when I hit this thing and you hear the sound, before you even call it a bell or anything, that's what consciousness is. Or you feel like something is warm or cold, before you say it's warm or cold, the sensation. Consciousness is very simple. But then what arises is perception. And an interesting thing about perception is it's a learned experience. And that's useful. It's just two interesting things about it. One is that it's a learned experience, and the other is that there are a lot of, I think the Buddha calls them hallucination perceptions. They're kind of deluded in some ways, or they're not true. Okay. So, for example, if someone's blind, born blind, and then they get their sight back, they actually kind of almost don't want their sight because everything's so confusing. They can't separate out bodies or trees from anything else. It's just like this big blur. So separating things out is actually a learned experience. We learn, you know, what attractive is. You know, the Madison Avenue's, you know, conditioning us all kinds of way. If you wear this, if your hair looks like this, if you have this kind of sports car, or you dress like this, I mean, it goes on ad nauseum, right? That's a learned experience. A lot of perceptions actually come out from our primitive evolution. I can't remember exactly all the components, but basically people say, well, you know, there are these fundamental qualities that came so we could survive. So one was respect for authority. You know, someone's in charge of the tribe or whatever, right? Another is disgust, which was basically to prevent us from eating rotten meat, things like that. Another is, you know, kind of fairness. I saw this amazing video one time where they were feeding these two monkeys something that wasn't very appealing, but they were eating it. And then the guy got out and gave a kiwi to one monkey. And the other monkey was just outraged. I mean, they were giving coins and he just picked all his coins and threw them out the door. I was so mad about this inequitable treatment. And that is another quality I can't, maybe it's fairness or something. Well, I did say fairness, so I can't remember what the other one is. But these primitive urges then kind of flow up into mental constructions. And so sort of knowing that helps us kind of not get so lost in things. And different people, just because of the way their genetics and their cultural conditioning, have different perceptions and views. So, you know, this plays out in obvious ways you can think about in politics. Right? About, you know, whether you're, you know, conservative or liberal. whether you put a lot of emphasis on disgust or whether you put a lot of emphasis on fairness, for example. So we go on about perceptions, or racial perceptions, religious perceptions. Why is it useful to talk about that? Well, they're relative concepts. They're views and opinions. And it's not to say we shouldn't have them. But we can kind of see that's what they are. They're just views and opinions, and not get so attached to them that we cause all kind of suffering and get into fights. We just kind of see, well, this person has a different set of conditioning, and meet them that way rather than getting into all judgment and rage about it. So when perceptions come up, it's just useful to, oh, this is my view, this is my opinion. And it's okay to have it, but then not to get outraged by it. I mean, because it's easy to do, I think, given the craziness that goes on in this world. The other aspect of perception, which the Buddha calls hallucinations of perception, are that we see what is permanent, we see permanence in that which is impermanent. And from a Buddhist perspective, everything's impermanent. And since everything's impermanent, that means everything is inherently unsatisfactory. You just can't line it up. You know, you get the, Joseph Goldstein told some story about, he went out and he bought this incredible mattress, and he thought he was going to be able to just lie down on it and he'd be fine. And he's down there 15 minutes and he turned, it's just like you can't do it. You can't sort of arrange everything so we always have pleasant emotions, we always have pleasant physical experiences. And understanding that, and then say, okay, well, if that's true, then I need to find some way to meet this more skillfully. Can I learn to open with it? And there's immense freedom with that. I mean, there's a lot of talk in this practice about, pushing our boundaries, our edge. And it's not to torture yourself. I mean, you want to do it in a skillful way so you don't get overwhelmed or traumatized or re-traumatized. But if you kind of learn to be more and more with these things, then there's just more ease. And I want to make a big disclaimer here, because I know so many people who come here and try and develop samadhi, which is actually calm, and his intention is to make you feel good, who come in and they start, I got to focus, and then they don't focus, and then they start beating themselves up. And, Maddie and I taught 2 years ago a class on the inner tyrant, the judging mind. And a guy had been off on a 6-week retreat or a 3-month retreat. And he said, it was such a good workshop for me, because all I did for the whole 3 months is I should try harder. And it's not that you shouldn't put effort in it, but there has to be some wisdom to it. That if there's all this aversion and tightening up, what mindfulness can do is this observation, is that if, it pays attention. I mean, it's not attention, but it's the quality that keeps attention focused on something rather than bouncing all over the place. Okay, and if you focus on things enough, you start seeing the nature of them. You start seeing they're all impermanent, for one thing, so that you can't hold on to anything. And that's kind of wisdom arises out of that. If you actually see for yourself, I can't do this, I can't hold on to this, and that the holding on to it creates some form of stress. And this is sort of how, a lot of times people say, well, let go, but it's more like letting be, to be with things and see that what we're doing creates unnecessary stress or dissatisfaction. And so, if you get lost in thoughts and you're, telling these stories about this person shouldn't be that way or that, or have some particular thought, you can look at the thought and say, well, I mean, this is the third foundation. Is this creating suffering or not? Okay. So I wanted to just give you an idea of the flavor of this discourse. And it, for each foundation, before I go, what's unique about the first three foundations, I want to emphasize, is it says don't do anything about it. Just observe. So if you have you know, if your mind, well, I'm going to read this so you get a sense of it. But after the fourth foundation actually sort of says, you know, like if you have a hindrance, like there's this tremendous aversion, it says you need to work with it some way, you need to do something about it. So there's this kind of, or if you have sloth and torpor, torpor is such a great name, then you might, you need to work with that rather than getting lost in it. Or if you have doubt, these are the hindrances that you actually make an active effort to do something. So if you can be with things, the practice is just to observe. But if you getting caught in aversion or desire, or maybe greed's a better word to use, and you're just totally lost in it, then you want to take some skillful action. So it's a question of whether you can be with it or whether you're getting lost or not. And the same thing is probably true when you're trying to meditate. You know, if you're just lost in aversion, I mean, you just can't let go of it, then do something else because you don't want to cultivate aversion. So it's a very delicate art. Okay. So I want to just read this little section on the third foundation. And there's a refrain which comes after every one of the foundations. Okay, so the same thread is just replace mind with body or vedana, feeling tone. Okay. He says, and how monks, and we can be monks too, lay people can do this as well, okay? Does he regard the mind abiding, how does he regard to the mind, abide contemplating the mind? And he says, he knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. He knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. He knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. He knows a contracted mind to be contracted, and a distracted mind to be distracted. He knows a great mind to be great, and a narrow mind to be narrow. And it goes on, you know. And you get the idea. He's trying to say you're aware of all possible mind states, and you're not. You don't need to do anything about it. So you're sitting, you know, and you at least have enough. Enough presence to be aware of what's going on, and you say, oh, the mind's distracted, and don't get into a struggle about it. Just be aware that's how the mind is. Okay. I was on a retreat at the Forest Refuge several years ago, and I thought I was going to sit down and be really focused and da da da, and I just couldn't concentrate at all. I mean, so the mindfulness is to just keep watching the mind, keep it in mind. That's in this particular case, the object of attention. I'm focusing on that. Or when you get more skillful, you just kind of go to whatever draws your attention most. And I thought, oh, the mind's distracted. But I got caught in it. And this is kind of useful in the sense of the distinguish between mindfulness and perception. Mindfulness is without any greed, hatred, or delusion. This is, sama sati. Sati is the word for mindfulness. Sama is right or correct or wise mindfulness. So a lot of times it's easy to confuse perception with mindfulness. And so I'm sort of aware, okay, the mind's distracted. That's a perception. But really what was underneath it was all kinds of aversion and striving. And so I wasn't seeing that. But the mindfulness of it sort of focuses in is, oh, there's aversion here. That's not mindfulness. That's kind of a cue. If you're pushing something away or you're trying to hold on to something, then there's that you're not really being mindful. I mean, if there's aversion, you can shift your attention to aversion. Just focus on that, make an object. If you can't do anything about the aversion, then you can see the aversion to the aversion. You can't lose. Okay. So basically he's saying, look at any mindset and just let it be. Right? Not do anything about it at all. And Well, let me read the refrain now, which is the same kind of refrain for each one of the factors of mindfulness. In this way, in regard to the mind, he contemplates the mind internally, externally, internally, and externally. Now, that's a little bit tricky, because externally means you contemplate other people's minds, you know. That's sort of pushing, that's going to be pretty sophisticated practice. You're trying to watch people and get some impression of what their mindfulness is. But it's kind of useful, you know, not just to be totally internally focused on things. He abides contemplating the nature of rising, of passing away, both arising and a passing away in regard to the mind. So this is kind of a really interesting aspect of practice. And this is true with the mind, with the body and Vedana as well, is that all the stuff's impermanent. These, you know, distracted mind arises, abides, and passes away. The undistracted mind arises, abides, and passes away. It's all just impermanent. Emotions arise, abide, and pass away. So a lot of times when you're practicing, just to see, maybe you're really stirred up by something. You're really angry or hurt or something. And then at some point, it's gone. So where was the person who was so angry or so hurt or so lonely or whatever? And knowing all this comes to an end kind of takes some of the charge out of it. So this is really good practice when you're kind of, or, you know, maybe some guy cuts you off or blows a horn at you, you know, and then the anger arises, but then it's gone. So we see the impermanence of it. And it's a good practice actually sometimes just to notice. Maybe you won't be aware of a thought. You might not be aware that you had a thought until after it's over. Or sometimes you might notice in the middle you're lost in thought, or at the beginning. It's just kind of useful to pay attention to that. And if you're lost in thought and then all of a sudden you're awake, you're aware of it, then pay attention to that. That's kind of neat. What does it feel like? It's a way to cultivate wanting to from observation, seeing that, oh, just being aware of thoughts is very freeing. Not caught in them, not believing them. So we're seeing it as impermanence. He says, mindfulness that there is a mind is established in him to the, now this is interesting too. We think we have to be so concentrated, but what he actually says is, you want to be established in mindfulness to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. So you're trying to want to maintain this continuity and just enough to be aware of what's going on. Okay. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So not clinging. Okay. So if you think about the Four Noble Truths, the cause of suffering is clinging. Larry Rosenberg used to say when he practiced with Ajahn Chah in Thailand, every time he looked unhappy, Ajahn Chah would come up and say, "What are you attached to, Larry?" It's another good question to raise for yourself. Okay. So mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness is this, you know, recollecting, knowing this framework of the teaching. It's remembering to pay attention to whatever you're focusing on, mindfulness of body, or mindfulness is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or, you know, mindfulness that there's certain kinds of emotions, seeing their impermanent nature, okay? But we also want to bring in wisdom. And, you know, one kind of aspect of wisdom would be with mindfulness, okay, notice what the Buddha is doing. He's having you step back from the mind. You're watching it. So he's making an object out of it. So where are you? You know, you is a thought which happens inside the mind. It's just an energetic force that shoots off. You're not outside the mind controlling it. You're being created inside the mind. You're held within the mind as an idea. This is really profound. I mean, this is sort of the third perception that there isn't any solid, unchanging self. You know, the thing that causes the most suffering, at least from my experience working with people in this practice, is this inner critic, this judging self. Well, where is it? It's in the mind. It's one part of the mind saying the other part of the mind is no good, or the body's no good. You're at war with yourself. And so part of the intention of this presence of mindfulness, of just observing, is you kind of see the war going on. You don't fight it anymore. And if you don't fight it, it doesn't have a lot of energy. So it's really helpful when you start seeing yourself criticize yourself, like, oh, well, that's a thought, isn't it? And who's it criticizing? I noticed this when I was a little kid. I thought, what's that going on here, you know? And Adi Ashanti, who's a kind of a teacher, kind of came up in the Zen tradition, but he's, I don't know if he really belongs to the tradition anymore. When he was a kid, he was watching adults, and he thought, they believe their thoughts. And they try and convince the other person that their thoughts are right and the other person's thoughts are wrong. So what are thoughts? What are emotions? They're just nature playing themselves out. They come and they go. I mean, and in some sense, that's really what this bottom line of this practice is about, is just kind of seeing this, that all this is just playing itself out. And what happens is that the mind contracts around things. So if you've got a pain in the knee or your nose itches, all of a sudden the whole world, you know, I remember one guy several years ago, it was just like his itchy nose. I mean, he couldn't, you know, it was his whole world. And so kind of, you know, in this discourse on mindfulness of mind, he said, well, notice the mind's contracted, right? So if you see the mind's contracted, that's the power of mindfulness. Right? Oh, the mind's contracted. And then rather than kind of fighting it, there's some wisdom here. I'm really locked in on this. So how can I be more spacious? Now this is kind of a part where you're responding, you're not just observing. Okay, so that's, you know, this practice is really tricky that way. There's parts where you're doing things and cultivating things, and there are parts where you're just observing and getting information. Okay. And in the beginning, I think it's a lot more of it's about being responsive and cultivating skillful mental states and letting go of unskillful ones. So we can see thoughts are unskillful, so don't encourage it. So if the mind's contracted, and you're actually, you know, this is getting out of this particular discourse, but what you might do is, Joseph Goldstein uses the expression, you know, maybe you're lost and really angry about something, or worried about something, or whatever. And then he says, and the sky is blue. It's just a mental way to diffuse a little bit the thought process to see that that's not the only thing that's going on. For me, it's more like coming into the body, grounding myself, being there and getting out of the head. And if there are emotions, maybe if they're really difficult emotions, there was a lot of discussion last time about anxiety and panic disorders and depression. You know, to work with those emotions, and part of doing that is coming into the body and finding parts of the body that feel okay. So if someone's depressed, their chest tends to be kind of, there's no life in it, there's no heart, and you don't want to go there. What you want to do is find some of the part of the body that feels okay. That might be maybe the lower back or something, and then breathe up through the lower back into the part that's pain, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain. Find some part that's okay and breathe through that and around the areas that's in pain. So now we're kind of stepping out of this particular discourse, but these are some ways, you know, like this, to say, well, just be with these things is nice, but when you get to the fourth foundation, the hindrances, we're actually trying to say, oh, I'm overwhelmed, I need to do something. Okay. Let's see. So maybe just some skillful things to do here. Sometimes it's useful to, if you think about it, there's consciousness and there's an object of consciousness at every moment, right? And they can't really be separated. It's like something has shape and color. But you can kind of focus on one or another. And let's see what I'm going to say about this. So, you know, sometimes when the mind's scattered, rather than focusing on the object, you might focus on the consciousness. Just where is the knowing going? And Joseph Goldstein gave us, he sort of likes to use a black lab as an example of an unmindful person. You know, it's just running all over the place, you know. Consciousness smelling this and jumping on this. And, you know, it's just, so you start noticing, oh, consciousness is scattered. And just bringing the attention to that shifts things. You know, sometimes, like, maybe, I remember I used to walk through airports, and I perceptions just arise all the time. And like, you know, well, this person's like this, this person's like, I just laugh about it. I mean, just aware of perceptions. All these kind of ideas you have about what people are, how people are, just from the way they dress or carry themselves, or it just really starts kind of shifting your way of seeing the world. You know, you have this perception, oh, this person's like this, and they must really be uptight, da-da, and there's this whole elaboration goes. What? And if you just, oh, there was a perception here. And then from that, the whole mind, so if the mindfulness is like watching perceptions, you can kind of cut off the elaboration that goes on. Let's see. Sometimes when we really get caught, you know, there's some form of resistance or aversion. It's really useful to just ask yourself what your attitude is right now. You know, or how are you relating to what's going on? Just sometimes just asking that question is helpful. Just asking the question like, oh, I don't like this. There's aversion here. And just seeing the aversion sort of helps us, like, could we get so lost in the aversion we can't do anything else? Or you can say, oh, I really want this so bad, you know? And just asking what is our attitude and seeing there's some sort of greed or aversion or delusion, is there some sense of identity? It's all, you know, I can't believe this person said it to me, and I want this, and I should do this, and, you know, all that. If you kind of just say, oh, what's my attitude here? How am I relating to this? So anytime you're struggling, it's a good question. And sometimes just asking a question. And, you know, people struggle all the time in this practice, right? You sit and you're told to, you know, watch the breath or something, and next thing your mind's all over the place, and then the knee starts hurting. And that's okay if you just allow it to be. But when there's aversion, it adds a layer of stress. Okay. So, you know, another way of kind of thinking about it is asking, what is happening that I don't want to be happening? You know, what emotions are there I don't want? Or what thoughts are here, what physical experiences are here. So when you ask that question, you see there's some kind of aversion, then you can kind of focus on the aversion, because things are the way they are. I mean, that's sort of, you know, what is this practice ultimately about? It's about being here now. That's the only place we can be. We don't get a multiverse. You know, we have all these different worlds to live in. There's no options now. It's exactly the way it is. And it doesn't mean you can't move wisely and energetically to something that's more skillful, but in this very moment, things are the way they are, and we want to learn to be open, to be able to open to that. And so if, and I've talked some about, well, if there's physical experience or emotions we don't want, then we want to find some skill to be able to be with it and actually to come to an edge with it in some sense. Sometimes what we do is another example of confusing perception with mindfulness is like maybe there's you're sitting with fear, and some teachers like use mental noting. So if you're angry, you just say anger, 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 kind of keeps your mind on, or fear, fear, fear. And Joseph Goldstein told a story about he's sitting for years just labeling fear, fear, fear. It's like a primal fear, not about something particular. And that's a perception, isn't it? It's a label. It's not what's actually going on. And then at one point he realized what's underneath the fear was that he wanted it to go away. And this practice is about acceptance, about opening to things exactly the way they are. And so there's this kind of, oh, everything's impermanent, so I'll be with it till it goes. Well, that's not acceptance. That's kind of bargaining, right? And you never get free that way. Okay. So, in some sense, the bottom line of all this is to see that all this is just nature playing itself out. It doesn't belong to anyone. We're kind of enchanted by these sixth sense experiences, you know, the mind being the sixth one, just the thoughts and emotions that arise. We get lost in them. And so we want to see their impermanent, ephemeral nature. We want to see their not self nature. So it doesn't mean you don't live in this world, but you see its empty nature. And actually, over time, one can expand one's awareness so that you just become so much bigger than this sense of identity that the mind creates. That if you can be with the totality of experience, that all this stuff is just playing out, creating the sense of you, me, da da da. It's just really complete, it's full. And there's this inherent clarity there. This is the direction where practice is going. Okay, so thank you very much, and I'm gonna bring that to a close. And so if people wanna leave, you're free to do now. If you wanna stay for part of the Q&A, that's fine with me. If you leave, just don't leave when someone's in the middle of asking a question or something like that, that's all I ask.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.